The winner of a proxy contest was determined in the snake pit. Officially, it was called the counting room. Lawyers for each side met with inspectors of elections, whose job it was to approve or eliminate questionable proxies. The event was often informal, contentious, and unruly. Adversaries were sometimes in t-shirts, eating watermelon or sharing a bottle of scotch. In rare cases, the results of the snake pit could swing the outcome of a contest and turn on a single ballot. Lawyers occasionally tried to fix an election by engineering the appointment of inspectors who were beholden to them. Inspectors commonly smoked cigars provided by each side. Management's lawyer would contest the proxies of the insurgents. "I challenge this," and vice versa. Lawyers who prevailed in the snake pit excelled at winging it. There were lawyers who knew more about the rules of proxy contests, but no one was better in a fight than Joe Flom. Kaplan goes on, "Flom was fat, 100 pounds overweight then," one lawyer said. "Physically unattractive, to a partner he resembled a frog, and indifferent to social niceties. He would fart in public or jab a cigar close to the face of someone he was talking to without apology. But in the judgment of colleagues and of some adversaries, his will to win was unsurpassed, and he was often masterful." The white shoe law firms would call in Flom as well when some corporate raider made a run at one of their establishment clients. They wouldn't touch the case, but they were happy to outsource it to Skadden Arps. Flom's early specialty was proxy fights, and that was not what we did, just like we don't do matrimonial work, said Robert Rifkind, a longtime partner at Cravath, Swain & Moore, and therefore we purported not to know about it. I remember once we had an issue involving a proxy fight, and one of my senior corporate partners said, "Well, let's get Joe in." And he came to a conference room, and we all sat around and described the problem, and he told us what to do, and he left. And I said, "We can do that too, you know." And the partner said, "No, no, no, you can't. We're not going to do that." It was just that we didn't do it. Then came the 1970s. The old aversion to lawsuits fell by the wayside. It became easier to borrow money. Federal regulations were relaxed. Markets became internationalized. Investors became more aggressive, and the result was a boom in the number and size of corporate takeovers. In 1980, if you went to the business roundtable and took surveys about whether hostile takeovers should be allowed, 2/3 would have said no, Flom remembers. Now, the vote would be almost unanimously yes. Companies needed to be defended against lawsuits from rivals. Hostile suitors needed to be beaten back. Investors who wanted to devour unwilling targets needed help with their legal strategy, and shareholders needed formal representation. The dollar figures involved were enormous. From the mid-1970s to the end of the 1980s, the amount of money involved in mergers and acquisitions every year on Wall Street increased 2,000%, peaking at almost $250 billion. All of a sudden, the things that the old line law firms didn't want to do, hostile takeovers and litigation, were the things that every law firm wanted to do. And who was the expert in these two suddenly critical areas of law? The once marginal second-tier law firm started by the people who couldn't get jobs at the downtown law firms 10 and 15 years earlier. They, the white shoe firms, thought hostile takeovers were beneath contempt until relatively late in the game. And until they decided that, hey, maybe we ought to be in that business, they left me alone, Flom said. And once you get the reputation for doing that kind of work, the business comes to you first. Think of how similar this is to the stories of Bill Joy and Bill Gates. Both of them toiled away in relatively obscure fields without any great hopes for worldly success. But then, boom, the personal computer revolution happened, and they had their 10,000 hours in. They were ready.